knowledge. But judge wanted him. He was a friend of the court. And I got a hold of several invitations for campaign fundraisers, and his name was always on there for Olson. He's a friend of all the courts. We contacted, I want to bring this up for Senator Gallegos. You mentioned Mr. Alpert that he should have contacted the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Well, I did that, and they weren't the slightest bit interested in my case. They said, sorry, they had nothing to do with things like that. So then Judge Herman got into the case. Oh, we filed for recusal. And finally, after several, maybe a month and a half, Judge Olson recused himself, and Judge Herman appointed himself. And he came down to Houston, and in the meantime, this judge had made me put up a $30,000 deposit for his friend to start his appraisals for $78,000. Well, Judge Herman threw out the appointment. He said it was ridiculous and insupportable. And he came down again and ordered them to give me my $30,000 back. Well, that happened. Then this fellow took me to appeals court, the 14th Court of Appeals. The appeals court ruled against me. Then I got a copy of another invitation from Eva Guzman, or appeals court judge, for a campaign party fundraiser. And who's on the host committee? The appraiser. He's a friend of all the courts. And he's not even an appraiser. So we lost in the appeals court. Then we went to a jury trial. And the jury trial wasn't allowed to hear any of the history of the case, the fact that Judge Olson had recused himself, the fact that Judge Herman came down and threw out the appointment, denied all the motions, dismissed everything, gave me my money back. The 14th Court of Appeals had thrown that out. And, let's see, where am I? So anyway, the jury wasn't allowed to hear any of this information. All they saw was this poor man who had done this work, and they didn't know it wasn't reputable work, that I wouldn't pay him. So they lost in that court. So this 15 or 20 minutes that my attorney said it would take to probate my husband's will, it took 4 years and 7 months and $368,000.
And your suggested?
My suggestion is just get a clean slate of judges. I haven't heard an instance of one of them that hasn't been devious. Since my case, new legislation was passed where a judge cannot appoint an appraiser because he deems it necessary. I think that was passed about a year ago. He has to show evidence why there's a reason to appoint an appraiser.
Actually, that bill was a Senate bill, 347, that I wrote.
Oh.
And Will Hartnett, state representative from Dallas County, was the House sponsor of that bill.
I see.
We added the words "for good cause shown," so a judge can't just do it
deeming
on his own. So there has to be some good cause shown before it can happen.
Well, all right, Senator. Also, at the start of my case, there was already something on the book stating that a judge couldn't appoint an appraiser who had any campaign connections with him. This was already on there, but they just ignored that. Mm-hmm. And the 14th Court quoted a little bit of that passage, but cut out the part about the campaign association.
Right. Well, part of the difficulty that you've pointed out, and other witnesses have as well, is that we have a judiciary in this state which is not like a lot of other states, where every single judge in our state is elected by the people. From the lowest local court judge to the Supreme Court, the Court of Criminal Appeals, are all elected by the voters. And I think you heard one judge say today that if they're reprimanded publicly by the Commission on Judicial Conduct, it makes it difficult for them to get reelected. But it's true that incumbents who have name identifications are often prohibitive favorites to be reelected, unless information like you're providing the committee is made more widely known by the voters. That's one of the aspects of the system that is undeniable. We elect our judges, and if the voters don't know enough about the judges, that's what happens.
One point I like to make is when most people vote for judges, they don't go to the polls to vote for judges. They go to vote for bigger issues, and they don't have recognition. They don't know who they're voting for. They either don't vote, or they vote for the incumbent, or they just push a button because it's not very highly publicized, the information about the judges. So when the newspapers endorse them, I'm not sure if they really have delved into the history of the judges when they're endorsing them. I saw endorsements for Rory Olson. I thought, my God, I haven't heard one person thought he was a good judge, but somehow the Chronicle did, and I wrote them a letter that they disregarded. But anyway, I made it known how I felt about it. But most people aren't aware that they're all going to go before probate court unless there's a trust involved. Most everyone is going to go to probate court, and they don't know anything about what goes on in there. It was a shock to me. It would have been a shock to my husband. I mean, we respected the courts. This is a place, the court is supposed to protect the integrity of the estate, not rape it. That's the job of the probate judge. But I don't see that happening. I mean, this is the one person who's going to save your estate. This is the one person who's supposed to be working for you. Well, I don't see why it's turning out that way.
Mm-hmm. Well,
anyway, thank
although
you.
Although your testimony is disturbing, we appreciate your coming and sharing your views. Senator Gallegos has a question.
Yes.
Ms. Taub, going back to your testimony about when you went to the
I contacted them in the year 2000, and this ended Christmas 2004. I contacted them because I saw the name of the woman who was head of the commission at the time. I don't recall her name. And I called, and I followed it up with a letter. And they wrote back and said, we can't do anything about a situation like this. No help at all.
That was their answer?
That was it. That's why I kept wanting to interrupt when you were telling Mr. Alpert, why did you contact them? I don't know if they've changed any, if the members on the commission have different attitudes, but at that time they couldn't be less interested. I had no one literally to help me. So when Judge Herman, I mean, it was preposterous because I didn't have time to grieve. Here I'm supposed to be grieving for my husband, and I'm in court for 4.5 years for no reason. No one wanted an appraisal. I was the only interested party, except the judge wanted to steal from me. Get his buddy, $78,000 versus $9,500. There's no justification for that. And this person wasn't even an MAI appraiser. Andy was turned down for state certification twice. He's been appointed by all the four probate judges. You look at the records. They all appoint him.
Ms. Taub, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thanks.
Chair calls Susan Conti. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Susan Conti. I'm here on behalf of my family. Excuse me. Days before an airing of a Channel 13 story on probate abuses in May of 2005, Paula Miller suddenly was no longer the campaign treasurer for Russell Austin. Days after this story aired, Paula Miller was no longer our successor temporary trustee, which she had been since October of 1998. Since October of 1998, through May of 2005. Paula Miller received over $1.3 million in cash and was paid an additional over $61,000 after she left by our now newly appointed trustee, Frost Bank. I'm appealing this I'm okay.
Cassandra, okay. We've all been through a lot, and it's very emotional.
There are things that we have found out very recently. For example, apparently there was a loan given to Paula Miller by Frost Bank in April of 2004 through 2005. That loan was paid off, apparently. I'm still looking into this. The following month, May of 2005, Frost Bank is now our new appointee. They've been appointed as our new trustee. Russell Austin brought Paula Miller to us. He gave her glowing reviews. We had never met Paula Miller in our lives. Apparently, Russell Austin knew her very well. After Paula Miller became our successor temporary trustee, apparently, after a period of time, Paula Miller also simultaneously became Judge Russell Austin's campaign treasurer and remained both our successor temporary trustee and his campaign treasurer for the next 5 years. We had no idea. If we would have known, we would have asked for Paula Miller's immediate removal. When Paula Miller became our successor temporary trustee, all of our properties were free and clear. All of our taxes were paid. And we had between 2.3 to 2.5 million cash in the bank. And we had a couple of lawsuits on us that needed to be resolved. Some of these payouts of these lawsuits were $750, $10,000, $15,000. Paula Miller made a production out of this. Paula hired lawyers to protect my family. Fee after fee after fee was paid out, including to her own lawyers. Now that she is gone, we have had to now borrow up to $1 million line of credit on one of our properties. The kindest way to put it, she came dangerously close to wiping us out. The total amount of fees paid to these court appointees exceeds $2,700,000. And this does not include fees that have been paid to our new trustee, Frost Bank, that has been here for 16 months. Paula Miller goes by a couple of names that we have found. We found this information by happenstance on the Beverly Coffin site by clicking on miscellaneous. For the campaign treasury reports, the names are Paula Miller, Paula A. Miller, Mrs. Paula Miller. Other names that could possibly be known are Mrs. David Lynn Miller, P.A. Miller Consulting, and Geneva Trading and Steel Company. If you refer to some of these names, you will also see donations to the judge. We also found out that she, apparently in 2002, co-authored with this judge Apparently they've had, I guess, a friendship for quite some time. For the last 16 months, we have been literally begging Frost Bank to market our properties, beautiful properties. Market them locally, regionally, and nationally for lease. Hasn't been done. One thing that is just beyond comprehension is within the last couple of days, one of our buildings that was allowed to depreciate severely. We had had a lease in this property since, I believe, 2000. Harris County leased it from us. From 2001 on, there was hardly any marketing done at all to lease this facility again. Within the last several days, Frost Bank, over our objections, is demolishing our building. A company named Wolf & Company, who we would have loved to have worked with, sent me an email just 2 days ago. And this is from Jeff Kaplan, Wolf & Company. I am distraught after hearing how much the situation has deteriorated since we last spoke. I was stunned when I drove by the building this weekend and realized what was going on. It was a rare building for downtown, and it is sad to see it go. In my gut, I am confident that if given a fair opportunity to bring it to the market, we could have found a creative tenant to do an adaptive reuse of the space. There is such a hunger in Houston today for any building with even a suggestion of authenticity. Is there anything that our Wolf Urban team can do to help you at this point? Please let us know. I am so sorry about the loss to you and your family and the city. If you want to achieve something, you can achieve it. If you don't, you won't. On the stand, my attorney asked Paula, what were your leasing efforts? Conti Properties in general. Let's get specific about this. If I recall, she said something about, well, couldn't really remember, couldn't recall, but there was a woman from Oregon. I don't know why it stuck in my head, but it did. A couple of months later, I found out who the woman was from Oregon. It was Beaverton, Oregon. It was the Nike Corporation. From what I understand, Paula didn't even meet them on site. Our foreman did, our employee of 20-something years. When I got the information, which was a couple of months later, I got in touch with Nike. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cards from Nike. I met them on site myself. Even though they wanted to take the property for an expo only, and even though in the long run they decided against it, the fact was she didn't even try. I have the actual facts that I had sent to Nike, dated August 9th of 05. When they were asking for specs on our property and any other properties that we may have available downtown. We had an issue that is so beyond comprehension at this point. You're not going to believe it. Give me one second, please.
Ms. Conte, let me ask you a quick question. The building in downtown Houston, is it demolished yet?
From what I understand, it was in process. Mm-hmm. I have not been able to bring myself to look at this.
This is way beyond the scope of this committee. Let me just tell you, we're not...
I understand, but I want you to hear what I have to say, please. I may never get another chance. We have two tenants. Should I say one now? One, a company called The Bus, a sports bar, and the other was The Grand Room. We brought to Paul's attention for I can't tell you how long that our tenants, their employees, should I say, were taking money on our property for parking, area they did not lease from us. They were charging between $5 and $20 per car, at least 72 parking spaces. This was brought to her attention. Finally, she brought it to court, and we won. We had videotape of these tenants / employees taking the money. She never even asked for sanctions, never asked for reimbursement, nothing. So we literally paid to win, and we paid her lawyer, to win, but we got nothing out of it. We proved the fact that they were taking the money. If you times 72 parking spaces times 5, 10, 15, $20, very small increments, $360, $720, $1,080, and $1,440. There's over 200 events at the Toyota Center across the street. Multiply it by 200. It's staggering. But to add insult to injury, the tenant at the Grand Room, who had the abatement for 4 years so he could put money into the building and we could put money, was paying his taxes and insurance during that 4 years with our money from the parking. We found out on March 8th of this year, the anniversary of my father's death, that this tenant named Joseph Rollins has been arrested. Three Houston men are accused of supplying cocaine to 16 members of a Baton Rouge, Louisiana distribution ring, charged in a federal indictment made public Monday. When Joseph Rollins was arrested, apparently he had over $434,000 dispersed throughout his vehicle. Another $120-something thousand in saddlebags of a motorcycle. Apparently Joseph Rollins had prior arrests dating back to 1989. Our successor temporary trustee never did a background check. That lease was for 25 years. We have now lost that lease. But let's don't forget that the commission for that lease was paid up front. I thank God right now that my family is whole, that my mother is beautiful and well. And what's kind of ironic is that the people that were taking the money off our parking, I actually brought my mother to a Bette Midler concert and we parked on our land. My mother was getting out of the vehicle and was approached by a man named Howard from The Bus, our tenants, asking my mother for $5 to $20 to park there. You can see me calling as quickly as humanly possible Paula Miller to let her know about this situation. I think we're just at a point we don't know what else to do. We are in a process of rebuilding, but we're also in the process of dealing with people that are now newly appointed that have ties to the judge as well. In a Business Journal article, we're still trying to figure out if this is dealing with my family, because if it is, this is an absolute lie and fabrication. For example, Miller was appointed as a successor trustee to a bankrupt trust. That's not us. That had a little over $1 million in assets and over a half dozen lawsuits involved with it, says Judge Austin of Harris County Probate. Miller was able to increase its value to over $14 million within 2 years of time it was handed over to her. I don't know. I've been told that this is referencing our case. If it is, this is an absolute lie. We were never bankrupt. We had ample money in the bank. All of our properties were free and clear. All of our taxes were paid. We had some issues we needed to deal with. But this also includes Randall Lamb, her lawyer, and Frost Bank, the head of the trust department, which now we deal with, Mike Doherty. As I've said, I'm just happy my family is whole. I'm happy my mother is doing beautifully. Just last weekend, she was at Jones Hall seeing Burt Bacharach. I'm happy that my entire family is together and well. But this has been an absolute nightmare, and I hope to God we can pull out of it.
Conte, I'm sorry to hear about what you've been through, but this committee really is here to listen to suggestions that people have for a way to prevent this sort of thing happening again.
I don't know if it's preventable. I don't know if it's preventable given the intensity of the cronyism, of the favoritism, of the non-transparency of who these people are. If you go to court, you think, well, they all don't know each other. They all know each other. You can look at the names. You'll see the same names over and over and over and over and over again. I don't think you can fix it. I think it is irretrievably broken. My faith in the judicial system is nil. You grow up thinking that that's where honesty lies. It does not. I don't think you can fix it. That's my opinion. It is irretrievably broken.
Well, fortunately for you and the rest of the people of Texas, this committee doesn't share your very dismal outlook on the future. While there's probably not anything we can do about your particular case, because we're not judges ourselves, we're going to try to legislatively improve the system that we've got and make it fairer for people in the future. And we're determined to do that.
I thank you if you can even make a slight headway.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Senator Gallegos has a question.
Ms. Conte, when they changed the trustee to Frost Bank, you said?
Yes, sir.
Did they give you a reason why?
Yes. They removed me. I got sued by the guardian of my mother's estate after 7 years of being my mother's permanent guardian of her person. After being bonded for over 7 years or so, I think, of up to $150,000 to take care of all of her needs. After being the sole person to take care of her childhood home in New Orleans, which got pretty devastated from Katrina, which as of August 19th, I have fully renovated. There was a deal. I think what was going on, from what I can tell from records, they were trying to force me to resign to a fellow named Michael Millich after Paula Miller. I found out, I think Michael Millich is a friend of Judge Russell Austin's. I refused to resign. At that time, more time went by. I was threatened that I would be sued by the guardian of my mother's estate, Louis Ditta. a deal was presented to me that if he were co-trustee with me and my brother would sign off, he would drop the lawsuit against me. I refused. In our trust, an irrevocable trust, there's a mechanism 5.3 paragraph that clearly states that the majority of the adult beneficiaries can appoint a trustee. We did that. I was the trustee appointed. Within a month or two, another document was signed that was an irrevocable appointment. The judge decided in my trial that he was going to remove Section 5.3 out of an irrevocable trust. So therefore, all Conti members would no longer be a part of the trust. And according to the transcript, he has modified and changed over 200 of these.
And all the properties you're talking about, they're in Harris County?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And except for my mother's childhood home that's in New Orleans. And it's her childhood home from 1924.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Chair calls, I think it's Rod Hardy. Is that correct? Rod Hardy, is that right? Is that right? If you'd identify yourself and who you represent and proceed.
Okay. I appreciate the opportunity to appear here today. My name is Rod Hardy. I am a lawyer, practiced commercial litigation in Houston, Texas for 22 years. Virtually all of the matters that I handled.
You want to pull that mic up a little closer?
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Virtually all the matters that I handle concerned contractual disputes and business torts. I've tried many, many cases in Harris County and other counties throughout Texas. I've appeared in front of many, many judges, both in state courts, federal courts, the bankruptcy courts. And I've also practiced a little bit in Dallas and Austin and San Antonio and to some degree outside of Texas. I left the private practice of law about 2 years ago, and I now work for a corporation as an in-house lawyer, so I have not been involved in the private practice of law for 2 years. I'm not here representing anyone, but for about a year and a half, in 2003 and 2004, I represented Roman Alpert and Daniel Alpert, the children of Mr. Alpert, who testified here earlier. That was my first experience of any significant nature in connection with probate litigation. And as a result of that, Mr. Alpert asked me if I would appear here to talk to you today. I want to say up front, I'm not being paid by anybody to be here. I drove down here myself. Nobody's paying my gas. Nobody's paying for my meals or anything like that. I'm just simply here because of the concerns that I developed as a result of my experience in the Alpert litigation in representing the children of the trust that he had created.
And Mr. Hardy, let me just tell you, we gave Mr. Alpert the better part of an hour or so this morning, so we've got most all the details we care to hear about that particular case. If you've got recommendations for ways we can improve the system, you as a lawyer can understand that we would be interested in hearing those.
Mm-hmm. Well, the underlying event or matter in connection to that litigation that I want to make some recommendations based upon that underlying event, but it concerned the appointment by the court of a lady named Karen Gerstner to be what was denoted as the receiver for the trust for Roman Alpert and Daniel Alpert. And, essentially, when I became involved in the case, I discovered that there were some indications that some of the stock portfolio assets of those trusts had diminished by a significant amount, as in close to 90%, while they were being held by Ms. Gerstner as receiver.
If memory serves, I think she parked them in 1.5% CD-type instruments and charged something like $300,000 to manage the assets.
Right. But I'm not talking. These were stocks, publicly traded stocks. They were not parked in CDs. They were parked in the stocks. They were in street name in a brokerage house that she had selected, and for a period of about 3 years, to the best of my knowledge, they simply sat there and declined in value by a significant amount.
And had no financial manager assigned to watch them.
Well, there was someone assigned to the account from the brokerage house. We were never able to develop the facts of the case. We did file suit against Ms. Gerstner, but one of the things I wanted to point out, because I think it's important when you're looking at how these judges manage these court appointees who are in charge of millions of dollars. When Judge Wood appointed Ms. Gerstner as the receiver, what he did was to write out an order, which I think he drafted himself, because the order was on his own motion, and it was early in the case, but he gave her all of the powers and duties of the trustee under the trust document. And this was all recited in the Court of Appeals opinion by which Judge Wood's decision was reversed. While she's called a receiver, she was the trustee of the trust. All of the trust assets were delivered to her, and she was in control of them and was appointed to have the duties of the trustee under the trust. When I became... When I became aware of the losses in the stock portfolio in May of 2003, it happened that Ms. Gerstner had at about the same time applied for what was called in Judge Wood's court an interim application for fees. Essentially, she was asking the court to award her fees for her services and fees for her lawyer's services for the past 3 or 4 months. And I then attended that hearing. That was the first contested hearing I went to in Judge Wood's court. And I notified the court of the loss in these stock portfolios. And Judge Wood's response to me was, I'm not going to let you cross-examine her about the losses in the stock portfolio. I'm going to approve her fees on an interim basis, and I'm going to pay her now. And then at the end of the day, when she tries to get discharged, you can bring all this up, and we'll sort it out then. But in the meantime, I'm going to pay her her fees. And this was a common occurrence in his court, in at least in this litigation. And in this particular case, with respect to these fees to Ms. Gerstner, ultimately what happened was, after entering an order in which she was given all the powers and duties of the trustee with respect to this trust, Judge Wood, before we could ever have the end of the day, before we ever had any final hearing or trial on this, he ruled that she was immunized from liability because she was a receiver. And what the law is on receiverships is you look at the terms of the order appointing the receiver. There's no general rule that receivers are always immune from liability. You look at what they're supposed to do. You look at the function that they're performing. And the Court of Appeals rightly decided, as we argued, that her function was not that of a receiver, but rather it was that of a trustee, and that she owed fiduciary duties to the beneficiaries of this trust, and they reversed it, and now it's coming back to Judge Wood, and now it's going to be heard again. And I'm not going to be representing the beneficiaries in that case. But in any event, the result of Judge Wood's ruling was to prevent, by summary judgment, prevent us from having our day in court. Now, Ms. Gerstner was entitled to her day in court, but she got it through a summary judgment, which has now been reversed. But the beneficiaries were denied that day in court. And in fact, in the meantime, she was paid significant sums of money. Mr. Alpert said, I think, $300,000. I'm not aware that it was that much, but it was a significant sum. I know when I was involved in the case, she had been paid already about $70,000.
Okay, Mr. Hardy, now we're going into great detail about a matter over which this committee has absolutely no jurisdiction.
All right.
And I'm going to repeat again. I am interested in hearing what suggestions you have that we can do. We can't do anything about that case. Mm-hmm. What suggestions do you have for us that we can draft and pass as legislation that the governor can sign next year that will help this kind of situation in the future? That's what we're here for.
What I argued to Judge Wood consistently was, we need to have a jury decide these fees. We should not have you, who appointed this person to be the trustee of this trust, deciding whether these fees are reasonable. There needs to be measurable benefits to the estate before you cut checks of $70,000, $80,000 to these court appointees. And we never got to that point. And it was a constant problem throughout the litigation. And you ask, what do I recommend? I believe in the jury system. And in the litigation that I handled as a commercial litigator throughout my 22-year career, a suit would be filed. You would have discovery disputes. You would have arguments in front of the judge. But if the case wasn't settled, ultimately it went to a jury, assuming one of the parties wanted a jury, it went to a jury. And once the jury made their decision, a judgment would be entered, and then the money would have to change hands. Then somebody would have to pay or somebody would be found not liable. That's not the way it works in these probate courts, at least not in the case that I was involved in. Significant sums of money were being paid out by the court without the benefit of a jury's determination. And I've heard all these people talk today about these draconian matters that have occurred, and they're horrible. I mean, they just sound terrible to me. And the Albert case is a huge mess. I mean, it's a huge mess. Even Judge Wood apparently said on the record that he doesn't have any confidence that the judgment that he entered is going to withstand appellate scrutiny. But in the meantime, all of these people have been paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, and a jury didn't get to decide those fees. A jury should decide whether those fees are reasonable. A jury should decide whether there's been a benefit to the estate. And I don't know exactly how you get that jury implanted into that case early on, but I've heard talk today about some $5,000 limitation on when a judge can approve a payment. Well, what if Ms. Gerstner has submitted 10 applications for fees and each one is $4,999? I have some real doubts about whether she should be allowed to have $49,999 with only court approval. And so what I would suggest, and I think the challenge for this committee and for this legislature, is to figure out in the probate context how you can get a jury involved early on. Because I think there is a real confidence issue by the people who have had to go to probate court, by the ordinary citizens who have had to have disputes in the ordinary court, probate courts. Those people are not confident in what's going on, and it's because of the age-old problem that we have when we elect judges. But in the probate court, it's emphasized even more because, say, in Harris County, you got four probate judges, and you've got this club of supporters, this club of lawyers, of auditors, and accountants who support those four judges. And so it becomes sort of a microcosm of the bigger problem. But the public and these people in this room have lost confidence in the probate court as an institution, and I don't blame them. I don't blame Mr. Albert for losing confidence in it. His trust that he created for his son was decimated, and I don't know if he's ever going to get it back. His case is on appeal. I think that the case, that the judgment against him is going to be reversed. But in the meantime, the trustees' lawyers, the auditors, the accountants, their lawyers, I mean, there were seven different professionals in that case who were seeking to feed off the trough of that trust. And there has to be a way to get a jury involved early on in those cases, and early on in those attempts by these court appointees to get paid. And I'm concerned about a $5,000 limit. $5,000 is a lot of money to me. I think it's probably a lot of money to these people in this room.
Mr. Hardy, let me ask you, did you not ask for a jury, or was there not an opportunity in the proceedings earlier in the process for you to ask for a jury in your matter?
I didn't ask for a jury on the one application for her fee that I was telling you about.
Could you have?
I don't think so.
So it's your recommendation, I take it from what you've been saying earlier, that we ought to write into the probate code that there should be an opportunity for a lawyer to request, or a party to request, a jury at an earlier time.
Right. And if the parties are in agreement, obviously that the fee should be paid, there doesn't need to be a jury trial. But if there's a dispute,
right,
I think there should be a jury trial. And on summary judgments, one of the things that happened in our case, there were a series of summary judgments that were issued by the court. In the case against the receiver, there was one, and it basically gutted the case. And that's been reversed, and now that's going to go back and be retried. But there were a series of summary judgments against Mr. Albert that were, in my view, not legally supported. And the result was that when he did get to have a jury trial, significant legal decisions had already been made, which limited what was going to be presented to the jury. And those decisions were against him. And I've always thought, particularly in complex cases, be it in probate court or other courts, that in this day and age, you can't have a single judge in state court hearing a summary judgment. You know, far too often, these judges are faced with complex motions for summary judgment. They don't have the staff that federal judges have to research the law, and so I think they make mistakes. And I don't know what Judge Wood's thinking was on these summary judgments. I know he made an egregious mistake, in my view, on the trust on the receiver case. I don't know what his thinking was on the summary judgments he issued against Robert Alpert, but I think those are flawed, and I think they will be reversed on appeal. But I think for summary judgments, there needs to be a mechanism by which a panel of judges can review those summary judgments separate and apart from the trial judge, so that you can get a collective thinking of not just one judge, but several judges to decide crucial summary judgment issues. Because once those summary judgments are issued, you know, for one thing, if it's not a final summary judgment, then you've got to go litigate all the other issues in the case. It may be, as in Mr. Alpert's case, it may be years